Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-1092 et al. BNSF Railway Company Petitioner versus Surface Transportation Board et al. Mr. Bress for the petitioner, Mr. Light for the respondents, and Mr. Lesser for the interveners.
Mr. Bress, good morning.
Thank you. Judge Henderson, and may it please the court, I'd like to first address the issues that were raised in this court's order of last Friday. I'll give a short answer and then elaborate if that pleases the court. The short answer is that the three-year automatic dismissal argument was raised timely in a manner appropriate under the board's rules. The board then addressed it on the merits without raising any timeliness objection or issues, which would have forfeited any untimeliness anyhow and also exhausted the argument. The board then raised no untimeliness issue before this court on appeal, which would doubly have forfeited any such argument had there been one to begin with.
All right, now let me ask you. You raised it for the first time in July of 08.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And in October of 07, a few days after the three-year deadline expired, what did you, filed for reconsideration?
We filed a motion for reconsideration of the September 10th, 2007.
Now, why wasn't that, why wouldn't that have been timely, particularly in view of our decision from 06, which put your client on actual notice that you've got to raise this? I think you raised it in a footnote in the petition for reconsideration in that case.
Yes.
And we said, even assuming the footnote argument is not fatal, it's not timely in a petition for reconsideration. So you have that decision before you. You don't bring it up in the petition for reconsideration. Maybe that's why you didn't, because we'd already said that's too late. And then you bring it up in response to WFA's response in July of 08. Is that right?
Perhaps I could explain why we did it and then explain why it didn't violate any timeliness rules. Would that be useful to you, Your Honor?
Right.
All right. Well, when the board made its decision in September of 2007, the 3 years had not yet run. So it would not have been ripe for us to raise the issue before the board's decision in September of 2007.
Right. It ran at the next
month. How do we know it had not run? When did it start?
Oh, because they filed their complaint in October 19th of 2004. So 3 years would run to October 14th.
And you cite a regulation to suggest that. I won't detract from Judge Henderson's line of questioning, but it's not clear to me when this three-year period necessarily begins. But
Your Honor, that's under Regulation 1111.8.
I read it.
Okay. Well, I'll answer this, and then
Let's
we can go
assume.
Back if you'd like.
Okay.
So at any rate, it wouldn't have been ripe to raise it before that decision.
Okay.
That decision was also not incorrect as a matter of law when it was decided. The September 2007 decision, because the 3 years hadn't run. Now, perhaps on reconsideration, we could have argued that it was arbitrary and capricious because allowing WFA to move forward when everybody knows the time limit would run would be arbitrary and capricious, but it wasn't contrary to law. We didn't have an ability at that point to argue that the September decision was contrary to law, in other words, and so we didn't argue it. There was a second reason, by the way, why we didn't argue it. We believed at that point that the September decision was best read as a final decision rejecting the challenge that had been made to the reasonableness of the rate and then reopening the proceedings thereafter to,
right.
To permit.
You lost on that, right, when we dismissed the petition for review in the spring of 08.
In 2008, Your Honor, for the first time, the board filed a motion in this court asking to dismiss WFA's petition for review from the September decision. And in that filing, May 19th of 2008, the board said, no, our September decision was merely interlocutory and didn't conclude anything with administrative finality. 2 months after that is when, in our pleading in response to their primary supplemental pleading, we said, then this proceeding has to be dismissed automatically.
Well, let me ask this. How could you think that was a final order in September of 2007 when it gave WFA another opportunity to submit?
Well, you can have a final decision and then a reopening afterwards, and the word reopening was actually used. They said reopening of the record on page 20 of that order, Your Honor.
Reopening of the record.
Of the record.
Okay.
And that's what we believed. But in any event, getting back to whether it was timely or not, we don't believe that we could have raised an unlawfulness argument on reconsideration in October. We raised it at a point that was appropriate in the board's procedures. The board's procedures, and I think it's 1111.5, provide that a motion to dismiss can be made at any time. Now, while we didn't file a motion to dismiss, our pleading in response to their primary supplemental pleading was effectively that. And if we could have filed a motion to dismiss at any time, then surely we could have filed that same document in that form at that point. The board has never construed its rules to be preclusive of such a filing. And you know, one point that I'd like to make also is there was no, you know, as I've explained, there was no intent to sandbag, but nor was there any sandbagging effect. And I think that's important for you to understand to the extent you're looking at fairness in this case. It was quite certain when we did file our argument for automatic dismissal, and would have been just as certain the prior fall, that the board was going to reject it, because the board had ruled definitively in 2006 in an AEP Texas case where we had been arguing for a three-year automatic dismissal that it does not apply to complaint-initiated proceedings. So they would have turned us down anyways. Moreover, what went on from October 19th, 2007 forward still remains to be decided, even if we're right about automatic dismissal. The board may on remand decide that what happened on October 19th, what happened after then, was a reopening of the proceeding. And so everything that happened from that point forward may still have validity. In our view, it would be merely prospective validity, but it's not a waste of the party's time in that event.
And what authority is there for the reopening authority extending the three-year deadline?
Well, in our view, Your Honor, a reopening wouldn't extend the three-year deadline. In our view, the case would be automatically dismissed as of October 19th, 2007,
right. But
they could reopen it with prospective effect. They addressed the ability to reopen matters with prospective effect in major issues itself. Now, even if we had been untimely, the board's consideration of the issue on the merits and their failure to raise untimeliness under the vast weight of judicial precedent, including in this court, would say that the board at that point would have forfeited any such claim. This court hasn't addressed it in a wholesale way, but in Bowdoin versus United States, which is 106 F3rd at 433, this court so held in a case before it. I think the best discussion of this issue is actually in the Seventh Circuit case called Esther versus Principi, and that's 250 F3rd 1068. And that court head-on looks at the question of, do you treat a failure of an agency to raise something before it the same way as you treat the failure of a party to raise something in district court? In other words, you treat it as having been waived. And the court said yes, and it said because of a number of reasons. One is judicial economy. You want issues to have been fleshed out before they get to this court. One is a lack of surprise to the parties when something is raised later. And one really relies on Chenery, in the sense that you can't affirm the board on a basis that the board itself did not articulate, at least when it's not jurisdictional. And as this court...
So your position is that the board should have said, not only does the three-year limit not apply, but even if it does, you've waived the issue?
That's right. They should have said, this has come to us untimely and we won't consider it.
I mean, the difficulty about this whole waiver point, it seems to me, in part, is the fact that for more than 25 years, the three-year limit hasn't been applied. Whether that was lawful or not, it just hasn't. But the board and the ICC had made it clear what its interpretation was with regard to a complaint-based proceeding. So you raise it initially by just saying it's not fair to go further than 3 years, and then you raise it again later saying this case should be dismissed. And then alternatively, you say, look at this as a reopening going forward from 2007.
That's right, Your Honor. But if they thought it was untimely, they owed it to us to say so. I mean, we have to have the ability to understand what the rationale of the board is in order to defend ourselves, because it may or may not be right if they say that it's untimely.
But, I mean, the issue is preserved in the sense you raised it, and they said the three-year limit doesn't apply at all.
Well, the issue is preserved that they disagree with us on whether it applies.
Yeah.
But for them to fail to raise a timeliness argument really would be a bushwhack. And indeed, this court...
How would that be a bushwhack?
Because...
As Judge Henderson's been reviewing with you, you filed in July of 08 saying move to dismiss.
Because before this court, Your Honor, we've had no ability to understand what argument they might have with regard. This is moving to their failure now to raise it before this court. But if they raised it before and they raised it in this court, we would be able to defend ourselves not only... as we have over the past few days, scouring the record to figure out what questions someone might come up with regard to our filing, but we'd actually know what their opinion is and their view is, and we'd be able to address it. And indeed, this court in Southeast Alabama Medical, which two of your honors were on last fall, held that an agency's failure to raise a timeliness objection, so it's the same sort of thing, before this court waived or forfeit its ability to try to win on it. And it's interesting. What this court said is it said that, of course, a petitioner before an agency must raise an issue at an appropriate time, but the agency also must raise an issue before us, before this court, at an appropriate time. And the failure to do that meant that the issue was forfeit.
Of course, the court sua sponte is raising this. The agency wants to win on the merits, saying that the three-year limit doesn't apply at all.
Well, Your Honor, that's true. The court did raise it sua sponte, but I'm not sure that that's a distinction with a difference. I'm happy to address the merits now if you'd like me to move on to it.
All right.
I do think that the statutory language is crystal clear that the automatic dismissal rule applies to complaint-initiated proceedings, and also that there's no plausible argument for a violation of due process in this particular case. The language of C says formal investigative proceeding begun under A, effectively subject to the three-year dismissal rule. And if you look at A, the only type of proceeding that A authorizes is one brought on complaint. It says the board may begin only on complaint. Now, there is a prefatory clause that says except as provided otherwise, but no one would ever say that an investigation is brought under a savings clause. It might be brought under the provisions to which the savings clause, that the savings clause saves, but it's not brought under the savings clause itself.
Oh, it's brought under the other provisions. Well, let me ask you, you're asking us to look at the language out of context, is that correct? In other words, we have 25 years of understandings about what's going on. We have an understanding as to what the ICC and the STB mean by a formal investigation, and we have a floor amendment. There's no legislative history as such suggesting that there was some intent to deprive shippers of their cause of action.
Your Honor, I would
when
actually
the board
just
doesn't, conclude within 3 years.
Your Honor,
whenever that
just...
3 years begins, which is an open question in my mind.
No, and I'm happy to address that too, Your Honor. I don't think it's out of context in the following sense. The ICC did have an interpretation, and that interpretation lasted for 12 years until the 1995 Act. After the 1995 Act, the board did not rule with any definitiveness on what the application of the new statutory language would be until 2006. So essentially, you've got a 13-year period where the ICC has an interpretation of different statutory language. And then you've got a two-year-old interpretation from the board that it still believes that language means the same thing
that
it used to mean.
Was the board acting contrary to its previous understanding during
and
that
the issue,
period.
The issue just hadn't come up in a way that they had to conclusively resolve
right.
it. But my point is that the language changed. And
were all the decisions on complaints resolved within 3 years between 95 and 06?
They either were resolved, Your Honor, or the issue just wasn't brought to a final culmination.
Well,
in other words,
they didn't rule, but
they didn't
were
rule
there decisions
it.
That were made 3 years later during that period where everybody just went along with the idea?
I think there were, Your Honor. I think there were. And in fact, there are decisions even since then where the carrier would overtly say, look, we're fine with the timing. In fact, that happened in, I think it was the AEP Texas case, as the carrier had gone along with a schedule that would take them past there. I think the more pertinent point is that
this rulemaking in the middle of this case.
That's right.
Here's WFA trying to get heard, and the board says, okay, now we're going to have a rulemaking, and they do all of that. And
Your Honor, thank you for asking that question. I think if the rulemaking itself had been the cause of their inability to proceed within the 3 years, they would have a good due process argument. And I'm not disputing at this point that Hatch says you have to have an opportunity and a fair opportunity to conform your evidence to new rules. The problem in this case is they had 11 months to do that, and they didn't ask for permission to put in new evidence. And they had not gotten a prohibition from the agency saying you can't. And this
is. But they're very clear, aren't they, in their brief as to exactly the instructions the agency gave them. And in this case, you have a new rulemaking where the case is held in abeyance, whatever that means, in the 3 year period.
For 8 months, yes.
But, you know, what does that mean? Does that toll the time or not?
I'm not.
I mean, I think it's not clear. But my point is that then the board says, all right, we have a new rule. We're going to apply it retroactively. WFA objects vigorously. The board says, no, we're going to apply this retroactively. It would be unfair. You'd be prejudiced because under our new rule, you would have presented an entirely different, not entirely, but many parts of your case would have been different.
Okay. Your Honor, I think that the better reading of that is what WFA's position was all along, and I'll agree with you, is that the new rule should not apply to their proceedings. But they proceeded down only one path in arguing that, and that path was coming to this court and trying to get this court to rule that the old rule should apply. Now, had they been appropriately protecting their interests, in my view, you don't just bet on or gamble on that you're going to win at the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit's going to tell the board, no, you're wrong, you have to apply the old rules. The board has told you in a final way in its regulation, we're going to apply the new rules to your proceeding. They told you that 11 months before the proceeding ended, and yet, and while you'd been complaining all along, saying, if I'd had the chance, I would have put in new evidence, at that point, you never go to the board and say, gosh, if you're set to apply the new rules to my case, I want to put in new evidence.
There had been. How much time was left after the 2007 decision?
At that point, there were only 40 days, Your Honor.
And the 2007 decision changed some things also, right? Or not? Compared to the rule.
The 2007 decision changed in their favor. The application of ATC and made it modified ATC, which would only have helped them, Your Honor, under whatever evidence they had.
With respect to the way they had organized the traffic group at that point?
Yes. And, you know, I think that the one thing that's very important to note is that the order that the board came out with on November 8th, which was the first, November 8th, 2006, which was the first
Can you
order.
Just pause over that? Are you sure about that?
What's that, Your Honor?
That the way in which they had organized, they had established the traffic group as of the time of the 2007 decision, was also in their favor with respect to the change in ATC?
Okay. Your Honor, no. Maybe I misunderstood your question. The way that they eventually did their traffic group.
Eventually by?
In 2008.
Yes.
The way they eventually put in their new evidence for the new traffic group.
Yeah, I understand that. That was in their favor, obviously. But with respect to the way the traffic group stood in 2007.
No, it was not, Your Honor. But they had notice of that back in November of 2006 of what ATC would be.
Including the change?
Including the modification to ACTC that happened in 2007. No, but they've never argued that that change adversely affected them. We were the ones that protested that change, Your Honor.
No, but
that change actually advantaged them in in the following way. What that change said is that the density of the SAR will, what the change did is it biased the analysis in favor of the SAR by counting lower rated traffic that's on the SAR, more giving it more revenue than it was due. That's why we didn't like it. In fact, by the way, that's why we didn't like MSP that preceded it. It's why we said that the method has to take account of the economies of density. Modified ATC does not take account as well of the economies of density, and therefore does bias the analysis in favor of the shipper. That's why we complained about it. The board hasn't disagreed with us about that.
It's a different, okay,
sorry.
The merits of it. I'm only continuing on the question that Judge Rogers was
sure.
asking. So your suggestion is they should have come in with alternative SARs?
Well, there's two different points here, Your Honor. They could have done that from the get-go.
Alternative traffic groups? I mean.
Well, they certainly could have done that from the very get-go. But even putting that, in other words, when they first started this proceeding, they, in our view, they should have realized that the board was likely to come out with a method that took account of economies of density. And so they should have had alternatives. But let's put that to the side. Come November 2006, we've got the board coming out with a final regulation saying we're going to apply ATC to you in your case. When you know that as a litigant, it is on you, and particularly because they had said over and over before then that if this new thing did apply, they would have to put in new evidence, or they would be obliged to put new evidence, to come to the board and say, gosh, you've got this new thing, please let us under hatch put in new evidence to conform. And we know they had enough time, by the way, and this is quite important, because in their later filing after the September decision, in their October 22nd, 2007 filing, where they said, yes, we do want to put in a new case, they attached to that notice a timetable. And that timetable said the new case at the outer limits should take 255 days to decide, not 255 days to brief, but 255 days to decide finally. So that was their view of how long it would take to put in conforming evidence and have it decided. Well, they had 11 months to do it, and their own belief was that it would only take 255 days.
Or the 255 being the days for the board to make the decision?
No. 255 days from the start of briefing and submitting new evidence to the time when the board finished its decision.
Well, let me just ask a practical question. If you want to develop a new proposal, I mean, it takes some time, doesn't it?
Well, no,
you're not just a computer computation, is it?
But my point is that 255 days took that all into account. In other words, when they said in 2007 this whole thing will take 255 days, that takes that into account. That takes the time to formulate your evidence and get it in front of the board. The other thing is, to be fair to us, they were on notice from February 2006 on, from the time of the notice of proposed rulemaking, that they were highly likely to have to develop new evidence if they wanted to do it. So I think you'd have to run the clock back if you were really concerned with what they ought to have done.
This is an unusual situation. I mean, in our major issues, too, we announced that, well, you can't rely on anything because there's no settled rule.
Yes.
But, you know, the board gave...
you said nevertheless, yes, the board gave
right.
it.
That's right. All right, so now we're in this situation where the board itself says WFA is prejudiced because our new rule gives new incentives to the shipper. And while the board rejected your challenge to the new traffic routing, nevertheless, the board's position was that was perfectly legitimate under the new incentive proposal in their rule.
That's right, Your Honor. I think what happened in between the two is the board saw that they lost under the new evidence, under the old rules with their evidence. But regardless of what I suspect occurred, because the board did flip in terms of what it was going to do, the board's view of what's fair and not fair is not the boundaries of due process. You know, due process is violated.
What are the boundaries here? You averted to the fact that maybe there would be a violation under certain circumstances.
Sure.
Under what circumstances?
I think if you don't have a fair opportunity to seek to submit conforming evidence when the new rule does come out of the blue and you've got no ability to seek conforming evidence, there would be a due process problem under Hatch.
What about the problem if they just take more than 3 years?
If who does, Your Honor?
The STB just takes
okay.
more than 3 years.
I think that could well be a due process violation as well, Your Honor. I think the STB, and one interesting thing is it's within the board's hands as any court, it's within its hands to control its docket and set timetables and all the rest. I don't think this rightly should come up all that often, but yes, I do think that there could be problems. But getting to the limits...
It's a Logan problem under those circumstances.
Yes, exactly.
So do we not need to consider this on the face, or your argument is we only consider this as applied?
I think it has to be as applied, Your Honor. And it's for the following reason. You only would consider it facially in terms of how you interpret the statute if you thought the statute was ambiguous, because the doctrine of constitutional doubt only arises then. And I don't think you really have to worry about the doctrine of constitutional doubt, because if it's ambiguous, we're going to lose under Chevron anyways. And the truth is that we only win if this statute is clear. We believe it is, and that it applies, and that there isn't a due process violation or problem. And I think the two best cases for there being
no... This is what I was trying to ask you before. So if you're right and it's clear, how can it be unconstitutional only in some applications?
Your Honor, there's many rules out there, I think, that some of their applications would be constitutional and some of their applications would be unconstitutional. And when that's true, and when the statute is not ambiguous but quite clear, it's the court's job to make sure that the statute is never, in fact, unconstitutionally applied by holding that it can't be applied in those circumstances.
Can you give a... I'm not suggesting there aren't cases. Can you suggest a case? Maybe you can think about it later.
I can think about it for rebuttal, Your Honor. But certainly here, I think I'd say there are cases where, for example, suppose that the shipper themselves are completely, I think they're responsible here, but suppose an example where the shipper's just dragging its feet in putting its evidence in. And the shipper takes so much too long that the 3 years runs out. I don't think anybody would argue that they've been deprived of due process in that circumstance by an application of a 3-year rule. It's just a repose matter. And no one would say otherwise. I think this case is very similar in the following sense. This court decided Duckett versus the United States, and the Supreme Court decided Levine versus the United States. Both of those cases involved due process challenges that were not made at the appropriate time. Levine is probably the most interesting. Levine was a case before a grand jury where the defendant was given immunity but nonetheless refused to testify. At that point, the court made clear he was going to ask the questions of the defendant and impose contempt sanctions if the defendant refused to testify. The defendant and his lawyer didn't ask at that point for the public to be allowed into the courtroom, but later on complained that the court hadn't allowed the public back into the courtroom for that phase, and therefore his due process rights were violated. And what Justice Frankfurter said in that case was, when we're looking at a due process violation to begin with, and that's the issue, we've got to look very specifically at what was going on the facts of that case. And here, your right to fair process was not violated when you never asked the court to let the public back in. Maybe the court would have let you let them back in, maybe not, but the court didn't deprive you of due process by not sua sponte doing it on its own.
Their argument, I take it, is that they were specifically directed not to change the SAC.
And that's just incorrect, Your Honor. At page 257 of the JA, you'll see what directions the board gave on November 8th when it opened the record for supplemental submissions. Now, it's true that the board affirmatively only asked for certain technical evidence to conform the existing record for the new rules, but nothing in there is prohibitory or even faintly so.
To say the information must be submitted for the traffic group described in our earlier orders. Doesn't must be sound like?
You must submit this information for the traffic group in the prior orders.
You're taking that as leaving open the possibility that you could do it for others.
Certainly leaving open the possibility that you can ask. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting here, Your Honor, is that same pleading said that BNSF would be the first one to file a submission, and then WFA would file the second one. It also said there would be no discovery. The fact that it said those things didn't stop WFA from coming in on the 14th of November and saying, wait a second, the ordering of filing here would violate our due process rights, and the lack of discovery would violate our due process rights. Again, for gosh sakes, if they thought that due process gave them the right to put in a whole new SAC case and required that they be given that right, why would they leave the big elephant out and ask for a couple of mice? I mean, it just isn't plausible. I think the much more plausible reason, Your Honor, is that since they were challenging the application of the new rules completely and saying the old rules should apply before this court, they didn't want to spend the money and the resources developing the new evidence. Because if, after all, if they won in this court, they wouldn't have to do that. It is expensive. Litigation is often expensive, but that's not an excuse. They made a strategic judgment to put all their money down, if you will, on winning in this court and never even asked for permission to put in conforming evidence before the board. It's hardly a violation of due process to hold them to that choice. If this court would like me to go on and address other merits arguments, I'd be happy to. Gosh knows, I don't mean to forfeit them.
Actually, I would.
Okay.
The double counting argument.
Okay. Yes, sir. Starting here with major issues. In major issues that was before this court, the board concluded that the fair way to allocate revenues in a for crossover traffic was using average total cost between the two segments, the OnSAR segment and the OffSAR segment. And that's important because if you allocate too much revenue to the OnSAR segment, you're biasing the analysis in favor of the shipper. All right, so they developed that as the method, and they specifically contrasted it with a method that allocates based on merely variable cost. Because if you allocate merely based on variable cost, you're not taking into account the economies of density. And if you're not doing that, you're biasing in favor of the more dense SAR. Effectively, you're encouraging the SAR to put on a traffic that's not all that profitable because it will be overcompensated by the nature of the formula. All right, this court agreed with the board that average total cost took account of the economies of density in the way that this court had earlier criticized the prior method for failing to do. So in the very first opportunity the board has now to apply its new average total cost, the board says that it's going to modify it, and it's going to modify it by compensating both segments first up to the variable costs are expended on both segments of a movement, and then only after that doing it by average total cost. So you're doing variable cost followed by variable plus fixed. So in that sense, you are both double compensating variable cost and failing adequately to take into account the economies of density. To put it in more layman's terms, you're still biasing the analysis in favor of the shipper. Now, you have to have a reason if you're going to do that. You're backing off of the more optimal way of doing it. The reason that they gave is that otherwise, low-rated traffic that's on the SAR particularly may not be allocated enough revenue to cover their variable costs. And they saw that as a potential cross-subsidy problem. All right. You know, first of all, we don't think it is a cross-subsidy problem because the truth is you'd have to have too little revenue to actually compensate you for the SAR's own costs to even make that problem arise. Here you're talking about too little revenue to cover average costs for the railroad. But secondly, even getting beyond that point, it's not a problem that's going to arise in a full-blown SAC case. Because in a full-blown SAC case, the shipper is not going to include, now that you're using ATC as your method, the shipper is not going to include traffic whose allocated revenues are not as high as the costs. Because that would be self-defeating. That would actually make the issue traffic have to cross-subsidize the traffic they're introducing on the line. So they're never going to do it, and they didn't do it here when they had the opportunity to put in new SAC evidence. The board actually doesn't disagree with us on that, doesn't say why a rational shipper would create a SAR that has that problem in today's world, post-ATC adoption. What they point to is their simplified SAC rules, which this court had some experience with, I think, last fall. And it is true that you could have that problem under the simplified SAC rules, because under the simplified SAC rules, the shipper can't choose which traffic is going to be on the line. But the simplified SAC rules, as this court well knows, are completely made up of rules that apply in those streamlined proceedings that relate to relatively small rate disputes. And if it's necessary to apply modified ATC in that, you know, very distinct context that's already made up of all of its own rules, fair enough. But the tail of simplified SAC proceedings should not be wagging the dog of full-blown SAC proceedings, and using that as an excuse to apply it to full-blown SAC proceedings really is irrational. And that's the basis for our EPA challenge on that, Your Honor.
Could I be clear, the two examples that you presented to the board, were they addressed to, were they designed to illustrate the concern you had with this modified ATC?
They were, Your Honor, and the first of those examples showed that if you had traffic that...
Okay. Well, and the board addressed both of those examples and said it was unpersuaded and gave a critique of them. I realize you may not agree with them, but...
Well, no, Your Honor, their critique was irrational, is what I will say. In other words, a board merely addressing it, and look, I know this stuff is hard and it's technical, but in order to determine whether a board is really arbitrary and capricious, we all do have to get our heads into it and say, okay, it's technical, but is their answer irrational? And here they addressed the first of the two examples, Your Honor, and as to the second, they acknowledged that their modified ATC would skew results in cases where the traffic does earn more than its variable costs, and their only rationale for that was, but we want uniformity. And the only thing that they can really point to in a full-blown SAC case that will ever exist now and into the future are these simplified SAC cases, and it's not rational to say that the rules that apply to simplified SAC cases must apply to all of them. In fact, as I said, simplified SAC cases are chock full of rules that don't apply elsewhere, and this court has recognized that. This court recognized in Excel itself in 2006, in turning away BNSF's argument that was based on a simplified SAC rule, this court said, well, yeah, but that's a simplified SAC rule. Well, the same thing has to be true in the shoes on the other foot. You can't say because you need it for the small category of small rate cases, therefore it must apply across the board. That really is irrational. And yes, Your Honor, it's true they gave an answer, but giving an answer is not enough unless it makes sense.
All right. Any more questions, Judge Rogers, on the...
No, thanks.
Okay. We'll give you a couple minutes.
I really appreciate your forbearance in letting me stay up for so long.
Okay. Mr. Light?
May it please the court, Eric Light, on behalf of the STB and the United States. To answer the questions that the court posed in its order of last Friday, first, yes, BN did forfeit the automatic dismissal argument. The general rule from the Supreme Court's decision in Tucker Truck is that a party must raise an issue at the appropriate time under the agency's practice. And the rationale for that rule is to allow the agency to take corrective action. And that rule applies even if the agency already has a predetermined policy on the issue. Here, BN violated the Tucker Truck rule. It didn't raise the automatic dismissal argument until well after the 3-year time limit had elapsed. Instead, BN first presented the argument 9 months after that time limit, when it was literally impossible for the board or WFA to do anything about it. Now, BN claims that it was unfair to apply for... Now, BN claims that since the board did not rely on this decision, this ground in its decision, that under Chenery, this court cannot rely on it. But that's a too broad reading of Chenery. What Chenery says is that where Congress has entrusted a matter to an agency, such as a policy decision or filling a gap in a statutory scheme or a factual matter, then yes, this court cannot substitute its judgment for the agency. But on a legal matter, which is not entrusted exclusively to the agency, then the court can decide that issue, even if the agency hasn't relied on that ground. So yes, BN has forfeited this issue by not raising it in a timely manner. Now, although the board did not raise this issue in its own brief, this court nevertheless has the discretion to address the issue of BN's forfeiture. And the reason why it should do so in this case, it is fundamentally unfair for BN to rely on this argument here. When the board instituted its major issues rulemaking, it put this case in abeyance. And WFA came to the board and said, board, don't do this. We've already completed we've closed the evidentiary record in our case. Under Section 10704, there is a 9-month deadline for the board to issue its final decision, and we would be prejudiced from delay. And BN responded to that and said, don't worry about that. In fact, everyone, including
when was this filing you're talking about?
This was in March and April of 2006.
And why was there a 9-month deadline at that point?
Well, under Section 10704, there's a 9-month deadline for rate cases.
After the close of the record.
After the close of the record, correct. And what Bien said is, don't be concerned about this. In fact, everyone will benefit from this rulemaking proceeding, and it specifically included those with pending rate cases. So Bien did not raise at that point any suggestion that this 3-year time limit would apply despite the case being held in abeyance. And in fact, it wasn't until after WFA presented its case, its supplement, its revised SAR showing a massive overcharge, that's the first time that BN piped up and said, hey, the 3-year time limit applies. But by then, of course, it was too late for anyone to do anything. But even then, BN didn't raise all the arguments that it's presenting to this court. For example, at the time, BN didn't argue that WFA should have presented, should have asked for permission to revise its SAR. It didn't argue that that the ICC had misinterpreted the 1983 interpretation, nor did it argue that WFA lacked a property interest in its rate challenge. In short, BN should not be allowed to avoid a fair decision on the merits of this case by citing delay that it previously told the parties and the board was nothing to worry about. Turning to the construction of 11701, the basic question is, did Congress intend to require the automatic dismissal of complaint-based proceedings that are not resolved in 3 years? And the answer is no. First, the statutory language does not compel that result. The term formal investigative proceeding by itself is not clear and unambiguous. It's not defined in the statute, and it's not used elsewhere in the statute. And the reference to subsection A doesn't clear things up. Through the exception clause, subsection A clearly encompasses both agency-initiated investigations and complaint-based investigations. Moreover, subsection A specifically recognizes that both types of these investigations are authorized under other specific provisions of the Act. I think one way of looking at this, Your Honors, is that subsection A would mean the same thing if it said, except as authorized by section 10745, section 11323, et cetera, the board may begin an investigation only on complaint. And in that case, I think it would be clear that subsection A encompasses both agency-initiated and board-initiated investigations.
But what would make it that only the board-initiated is formal?
Well, Your Honor, it's not. I'm not suggesting that it is clear and unambiguous that that is the only interpretation of subsection A. What I'm suggesting is subsection A is ambiguous, and therefore the board is entitled.
What makes it ambiguous that there's a difference between those two? If A said the board can initiate investigations either on its own or on complaint, and Part C says formal investigation authorized under this section has to be done in 3 years, what's ambiguous about the fact that both of those have to be done in 3 years? Unless there's something that makes one formal and the other not.
Because the term formal investigative proceedings is ambiguous. It could be referring to...
It could be ambiguous, but what makes it apply to one rather than... What makes it ambiguous in the sense that it only applies to board-initiated rather than complaints?
Well, there's...
Is there anything more formal about a board-initiated proceeding than a complaint-initiated proceeding?
I don't know about that, Your Honor, but I think the basic point is that it could refer to either of them. And since we don't know which one it does refer to, the agency is entitled to construe the ambiguity.
It suggests that it doesn't apply to both of them. Why is it unclear that it doesn't apply to both of them under the circumstance you're talking about?
Because since we don't know what it does apply to, it could apply to either. And I mean, I agree, it could apply to both, but it could apply to either. And since it could apply to either, one or the other, the agency is entitled to interpret it in a way to avoid serious constitutional difficulties.
Is formal investigative proceeding referred to anywhere else in the Act?
No.
How about in the regulations? Is it defined anywhere?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And because the...
Let me ask you so I'm clear. So you're saying that it can refer to either, including one brought by the Commission on its own initiative, even after 95, when that language is omitted, is because of the savings language in subsection A?
If I understand your question, yes. It could have been interpreted as applying to either or both, but the board interpreted it as applying
okay,
to agency.
Okay, that's before 95. Then in 95, the initiative, your own initiative language, is excised. So now I just want to find out if I'm understanding your position. Now you say that doesn't make any difference, even though they excise that because of the savings provision at the beginning of A.
The except as otherwise provided, correct.
All right.
Because the language says except as otherwise provided under this part. And then in the main clause it says the board may begin investigation under this part only on complaint. And those words, I think, are recognition that complaint-based investigations are authorized and begun under other provisions of the Act. For example, as we cited in the brief, 11701B specifically authorizes the board to begin an investigation into a violation, by complaint, into a violation of the Act. Well, if subsection A authorized an investigation by complaint, 11701B would seem to be superfluous. We also cited 10709G2, which specifically authorizes the board to begin an investigation on complaint for certain challenges to certain rail contracts. Again, if 11701A covered the waterfront, then 10709G2 would be unnecessary. Because the board's statutory interpretation, because the statutory language is ambiguous, the board's reasonable construction is entitled to deference. It avoids the absurd results of BN's interpretation, under which a rail carrier is discouraged from settling and in which it is encouraged to drag out a proceeding beyond the 3-year deadline. And more important, it avoids the serious constitutional difficulties that are inherent in BN's interpretation. The due process problem you have of dismissing a complaint without a final decision on the merits, the equal protection problem of one complainant getting a decision on the merits and a similarly situated other complainant having its case dismissed solely due to agency delay.
The problem I'm having is that you keep putting all these burdens on either the carrier or the shipper or whatever. Subsection C, you know, holds your feet to the fire. I mean, it says these proceedings are supposed to be concluded. Now, those two entities can't conclude them. Well, I mean, they can drop out or whatever, but it's up to the commission to abide by this 3-year deadline.
Correct. And the
So when you're saying, well, the shipper could then drag it out, well, that's only if you sit on your hands.
Well, the railroad could drag it out, and what I'm saying is that because that's possible, the board reasonably construed it as applying only to agency-initiated investigations. And yes, the board controls its docket, but parties can always file motions to dismiss, motions to strike, motions to file supplemental evidence, and the board has to analyze these things and give reasons explanations for why it's ruling one way or the other. So it's not necessarily going to be the case that the board will always be able to meet it, and the three-year deadline. And this case is another example. I mean, this is a case where it's not, it was mainly the board's doing here that this case wasn't decided in 3 years. We're not suggesting that BN caused the board to hold this case in abeyance, but what I'm suggesting is that there are situations where, a railroad would have, under BN's interpretation, would have the incentive to try and do that.
What do you say to their argument that they could have put in a new traffic group?
Your Honor, I think it's impractical to put in a new traffic group and have the board decide it in the time that was left and give a well-reasoned decision.
What was the 255-day reference?
That is, according to BN, what the time limit, the schedule that the shipper in this case proposed. But in the board's view, it would not be practical to put in a whole new round of evidence and come up with a reasoned decision on this case.
In 11 months.
In short, Congress could not have intended these types of results, and the statutory language does not compel these sorts of unconstitutional results. Addressing the merits, as for the traffic group issue, BN's challenge amounts to what is essentially an attack on the bedrock principle ever since guidelines that shippers have great discretion in choosing the traffic group. What BN wants this court to do in this case is essentially to tell shippers that it's now impermissible gaming for a shipper to do what the agency has always told them to do, namely to minimize costs and maximize revenues. But here the gaming contention has no merit. Gaming consisted of a situation where a shipper with low-rated traffic would group that traffic with much higher-rated traffic in order to obtain a rate reduction under the percent reduction method, which presumed that all traffic in the traffic group was entitled to an equal percent reduction. But here, that's not what happened. WFA had the highest rate of traffic in this traffic group by far. And so by maximizing its revenues, by including the Jeffrey traffic, WFA was simply doing what it's supposed to do, that is, maximize revenues. On the ATC issue, it's important to remember, when a SAR includes cross-traffic, the board's task in that situation is to divide the total revenues that the carrier earns between the on-SAR portion and the off-SAR portion. And here, when the board applied ATC in the first instance, it found that ATC could allocate revenues that were insufficient to cover the incumbent carrier's variable cost of providing service. This was an irrational result because traffic must cover its variable costs before it can start making any contribution to fixed costs. If traffic isn't even covering its operating costs, it's losing money for the railroad, and it certainly can't make a contribution to fixed costs. That's exactly what was happening under original ATC for certain movements. And the only way that could happen is through an impermissible cross-subsidy from other traffic on BN system. So it's not a matter of is there a cross-subsidy or a cross-subsidy on the SAR system. It's the original ATC methodology presumed with respect to certain movements that there was a cross-subsidy on BN system, and that the board is not required to adopt a revenue allocation methodology that is premised on a cross-subsidy. The two-step...
Yeah, can I just ask you, the petitioners are arguing, and you take the exact opposite position. They say under this modified rule, the step one and step two are giving double recovery. And you say, no, that only step one allows recovery of variable costs, and step two only allows recovery of contribution to fixed costs. Why are you right and they wrong?
Your Honor, the purpose of step one is to allocate revenues so as to cover variable costs, and step two is to cover fixed costs. Now, it is true that in step one and in step two, variable costs appears as a term,
right. But
the board is okay with that. That is a good thing because, as the board explained, traffic must cover its variable costs before it can start making any contribution to fixed costs. That's why the board modified it and adopted step one. As for step two, still including variable costs in that step, that is necessary in order to allocate the revenue contribution according to density, and to do that in a way that takes into account the diminishing nature of economies of density, as this court recognized the board had to do in major issues. If the board simply allocated in step two fixed costs and didn't include a variable cost term, it wouldn't be doing that. It would be ignoring the diminishing nature of economies of density.
What did you say to their argument that that's all well and good for a simplified SAC case, but has no need for that in this kind of case?
Well, there are 2 points. First, in this case, they claim that a shipper in the future will no longer include any low rate of traffic. Well, in this case, WFA did include, they much diminished the low rate of traffic, that's true, but it did include some movements, very few, but there were some, which where this issue arose again. And second, the fact that BN doesn't like the board's explanation doesn't make it irrational. The move from MSP to ATC introduced complexity to the revenue allocation methodology. The board has a strong interest in keeping things as simple as possible. This is already a sufficiently complex test.
The way he put it, there would be no cases where revenue over variable costs would be too low to cover variable costs, except in simplified SAC cases. You're saying that's not correct?
As I understand the record in this case, yes, there were movements where like three movements, I believe, that were still where this problem still arose. And the fact that, and I guess the other point, the final point is that the board has a strong interest in a uniform application for ease of administration. Here, the board's modification to ATC made good sense, and it should be affirmed. In short, Your Honor, this is a case where WFA litigated this case in good faith and at considerable expense, and it achieved a substantial victory. BN now asks this court to snatch that victory from WFA based on a procedural argument about delay which it said would not prejudice WFA. This is an irrational and unfair result, and this court should not sanction it. We ask that this court affirm the board's decision.
All right, thank you. Mr. Lesueur?
May it please the court, my name is John Lesueur. I'm appearing here today on behalf of Western Fuels Association and Basin Electric Power Cooperative. Western Fuels and Basin Electric were the complainants in the STB proceedings that have given rise to this appeal. Western Fuels and Basin Electric agree with the government that the automatic three-year dismissal rule set forth at 49 U.S.C. Section 11701C does not apply in rate complaint cases. However, and we also agree that the BN has forfeited its right to make Section 11701C arguments to this court. However, if the court does decide to address the Section 11701C issues and finds that it applies, generally speaking, to rape complaint cases, we would ask that the court also find that its application in the Western Fuels case is unconstitutional because it clearly deprived Western Fuels and Basin Electric of due process of law. In a complaint case brought by a shipper at the STB, fundamental principles of due process require that a shipper obtain a fair hearing and a final decision. As of the three-year anniversary of the filing of the Western Fuels complaint, October 19, 2007, Western Fuels had not had a fair hearing and clearly had not obtained a final decision. And we direct the court's attention specifically to the STB's September 10, 2007 decision, which was issued just 1 month before this supposed three-year cutoff date, where the board ruled that as of that date, Western Fuels and Basin Electric had not had a fair opportunity to present their case. And specifically, in that decision, the board found Western Fuels and Basin Electric had designed their standalone case and designed their standalone railroad under rules that were in effect in 2005. The board then found that in 2006, in a rulemaking proceeding, the board had made major changes to its standalone cost rules and decided to retroactively apply those rules in the Western Fuels case. Third, the board ruled that fairness required that Western Fuels and Basin Electric be permitted to modify their standalone railroad to address these new rules, particularly the board's new rule for allocating revenues on crossover traffic called the average total cost.
What is your response to the petitioner's argument citing JA 257 and the statement that you were not limited and you could have asked the board?
Well, in the rulemaking proceeding, the principal point we made was that it was unfair to retroactively apply these rules because we would have modified our railroad. I think everybody in those proceedings understood what our position was. During the course of the rulemaking, the board issued one decision where they asked us to submit a lot of new evidence on one particular issue involving our operating plan, and they said, don't change your railroad. Then when the proceeding, the rulemaking proceeding was over, they came out with some orders in November, and once again they said, don't change your railroad. We intend this to be a very summary procedure. So we understood where the board was coming from.
Which is that JA 257? The don't change your railroad language?
Yes, and there's another order that came out after that one, and I don't have the date in front of me. We cited in our brief where the board said, you know, the purpose of these supplemental proceedings is to basically, it's supposed to be quick and simply take ATC, MMM, and the new variable cost method for calculating market dominance and do it in a swift fashion. So it's very clear where the board is coming from. But I think more important than that, the board said in its September 2007 decision that we have not afforded you the opportunity. It was clear that the board, up until that time, based upon what the board said in that decision, was not going to let Western Fuels and Basin Electric modify their railroad. And I've heard the BN in here today say, well, you know, you should have asked for it earlier. It's amazing to me to sit here and listen to the BN say that when throughout our entire case, after our initial railroad went in 2005, the BN's staunch position, every single filing they made at the STB was you cannot change your railroad. They said it right after the rulemaking when they're now saying we should have asked what their position was, you can't change your railroad. When the board said you ordered in September of 2007 and saying you could change your railroad, the BN said, no, you can't. So I think under some fundamental principles of estoppel, you know, the BN should be a stop from raising these arguments. But more importantly, we viewed, we saw the writing on the wall and saw that we could not change our railroad. And the first opportunity we had when the board said you could change your railroad, we did. And just to address another point that was raised about timing, this 255-day schedule after the September 2007 decision, you know, you can't take that and go retroactively back in time to 2006. When that schedule came out, the board had issued a decision where they had decided approximately 80% of the issues in the case. And they had also ruled that we could change our standalone railroad. They had set some guidelines down in terms of what we could and couldn't do. We couldn't update any of our forecasts that were used in the standalone rate case process. We couldn't go outside the record except for very limited circumstances. So with all those guidelines in place, basically all the unit costs for our standalone railroad were in place. We could play around with the units, but not the unit costs. We could do a 255-day schedule there, which the board didn't adopt, by the way. They took far longer than 255 days to decide the case. But to go back and say, well, you could have done that a year ago would have been ludicrous. I can guarantee you, even though we're talking about things that didn't happen, that if we'd gone in 2006 and said, modify your railroad, the BN would have been screaming, no, you can't, and we would have had a big brouhaha, and it would take another 2 years to do that. So I've vastly exceeded my time here, and we would ask that the board or the court affirm the board's orders, and if the on the section 11701C issue, if in fact,
ask you one question,
sure.
On the merits, since the other side exceeded their time, maybe.
Okay.
This is on the STB counsel said that the reason in the second step of the modified ATC that you still looked at variable cost was that accounted for diminishment of economies of density?
Yes.
That is what he said? Why is that? Why is variable cost relevant to diminishment?
Well, I'm not an economist, but as I understand it, maybe I should just stop with I'm not an economist. But
well, as you may have noticed, neither are we.
Right.
we do have to decide whether it's arbitrary and capricious. The STB's argument for why it's not arbitrary is it was needed for diminishment of economies.
Right.
If we can't explain or understand the explanation, right, it's hard for us to make that judgment.
Right. I would say on ATC, if you go through it, you'll see in the end that with the VN's real concern about it is the weighting factors that are used to apply ATC. ATC in both the original formulation by the board and when it modified it to apply to contribution was what they were doing was consistent with the principles laid out by this court in Excel, that the methodology should take into account economies of density and diminishing returns there too. And I think if you read the BN's brief carefully, you will see that they agree that both of these methodologies, the old ATC and the new ATC, do that. Their concern is with the weighting factor that's given to variable, it's basically the weighting factors the board has used. And I think on something as esoteric as ATC, when you're getting down to how the technical portions of the formula should be weighted, great deference should be given to the agency.
I thought your chart on page 36 of your brief, was trying to explain that to us.
Right, and what that basically was intended to show was that under the boards, the way they calculate variable cost density, plays no part. And when you have the two examples the BN gave, if you start applying density metrics to the variable cost component, it produces absurd results, which is their first example where you have a movement that both OnStar and OffStar is just covering as variable costs. You apply unmodified ATC, and all of a sudden that line that's supposed to be straight across is moving, and that's inconsistent with basically the fundamental concepts of how the board's variable costing system works. And the second line basically shows, which is from the Excel reconsideration decision, modified ATC does take that red line and slope it down. And the BN's real issue really is the weighting in terms of how that slope is supposed to be sloped.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's see, does Mr. Bress have any time? All right, why don't you take a couple minutes?
I appreciate that. I try not to
weigh on your time any more than I have to. I'd like to address a couple of misstatements that were made and just clear up the record on a couple of things. Number one, the regs do distinguish in one way between formal and informal. I think there was a question from the court on that. If you go to 1111.1, for example, they talk about formal complaints. Now, this doesn't is formal investigatory proceedings, but it does talk about formal complaints, and there is a distinction between formal and informal complaints. And the distinction really is that informal complaints are more in the sense of starting a mediation-type proceeding, and formal complaints start an investigation of the board. This is quite clearly a formal complaint to the extent that formal and informal is an issue.
So that's why the board treats the 3 years as, well, it doesn't, but I mean in the 111.8.
It starts immediately.
The trigger as the filing of the formal complaint because maybe there have been these informal proceedings prior to that time.
There still can be, Your Honor, yeah, by letter and that sort of thing. But as soon as you file a formal complaint, that takes over. So an informal complaint is essentially a letter that starts a mediation type proceeding if you wish to do that.
In other words, I was trying to understand just from a practical point of view that once a complaint is filed, parties can file motions, et cetera, so that takes up some time.
It can.
In my hypothetical.
Sure.
They file motions for all kinds of different reasons, so the board has to look at those as well as look at the complaint itself. Meanwhile, if the time starts at the date the complaint is filed, this 3-year period starts running. Finally, the board disposes of all these motions and says, all right, now we're going to start our formal investigation. This is my hypothetical.
Okay.
We're going to start our formal investigation. That's what I find sort of odd about this proceeding.
I don't think there's any sense that the board's investigatory procedure only starts after the parties are done with all their briefing. In fact, if you look at page 3 of the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking.
Okay, can I just ask you, I understand, but I just want to be clear. Suppose the board gets 10 complaints all filed on the same day. And suppose they're all very complicated. And a reasonable board would take 3 years minus one day to decide any one of those. I mean, does the board have no flexibility under those circumstances?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, for the following reason. If you look back at the 1983 ICC decision, and we disagree with the result of that decision, but the board was faced with having an awful lot of proceedings before it that it had to get done within a 3-year period, and they didn't try to say, we won't consider them to be investigatory proceedings. Right. They said, we just can't get them done in time. Right. 111.8, by the way, is also far more valuable to you than hearing testimony from counsel now about how long they think it would take their proceeding to go. 111.8 says the board presumes that it only takes 210 days for the briefing to finish. They never raised futility before coming into court this day and saying we couldn't have done it in time in that 11-month period. And the testimony from the podium here is worth just about that.
Of course, 111.8 starts off by saying, absent a specific order by the board, the following general schedule will apply,
Your Honor,
in a standalone.
It's a presumption only. I agree with that. But again, you can look to that and you can look at their proposal, which said 255 days, the whole thing would be wrapped up. There's just no evidence in the record, is my point, to make a finding that says they couldn't have done it in 11 months. In fact, there's evidence otherwise. I wanted to answer your question, Judge Garland, about cases that might deal with, and it struck me when I was sitting there, it's really overbreadth is really the doctrine that they're arguing, and overbreadth only applies in the First Amendment context. And otherwise, you do have to determine when the statute is actually unconstitutional or when it isn't. The parental notification case that the Supreme Court decided, I think it's pronounced IOT, a couple of years ago is a good example of that, where you had a statute that in some of its applications could be unconstitutional and some of those applications would be constitutional. ATC, there's been a lot of discussion about variable and fixed cost and how all of that works. We're not arguing against the notion of doing it by average total cost, the relative average total cost on each segment. That's how we think it should be done, and that does include variable as well as fixed. The problem is if you only allocate revenue by variable cost to begin with and then cover that, and then you allocate by relative average total cost, You are looking twice at variable cost, and what that does is bias the analysis. Now, there may be reasons to do it.
That's what I'm trying to understand. Their response is, if they don't do that, then the economies of density aren't taken into account.
No, Your Honor.
And how are they taken into account,
Your Honor,
even without doing that?
Our point is not that you shouldn't take do average total cost by average total cost, which includes variable and fixed. It's their first step we object to. It's allocating revenue at the initial step based on variable cost. There's just no reason to do that, given that the shipper is in control of the traffic it chooses to put on the SAR. And the shipper, if you use ATC, simply has no incentive to put on the SAR traffic whose revenue would not at least equal its variable cost, because that would be self-defeating. But since the shipper controls what traffic it puts on the SAR, this is wholly in their...
There may not be enough traffic. A high revenue to variable cost ratio.
Well, then you would just have less traffic, Your Honor. In other words, all they really have to include is their own issue traffic. Any other traffic they choose to include, they're including because they say a real railroad would include that other traffic because it shares costs sufficiently. But you wouldn't include other traffic that's really just going to make it more expensive to run your railroad and drive revenue down because it's not covering its own costs. That's kind of just elementary in how you design a SAR. You wouldn't do that. And so our point is that now that everyone's on notice that ATC is the rule, a shipper won't rationally choose really low-rated traffic that doesn't cover its costs. Now, the board has said to you today that there were a couple of examples of traffic that, notwithstanding the adoption of ATC, a WFA did include that wouldn't cover its own variable costs, the revenue for which would not cover its own variable costs. They never pointed out any such traffic in their order. All they said is it included some low-rated traffic, but low-rated is a malleable term that could include relatively low profit or no profit at all. They pointed out none that had no profit at all, and I would note that if the shipper were foolish enough, a shipper were foolish enough to want to include traffic, that it would have to cross-subsidize. And therefore, to put a case together that drives down the reparations it could get, that hangs on the shipper. I mean, the shipper can always include traffic that would be silly to include. And that would be the case here if they were to do it. Finally, I guess I'd just like to say in closing that if you're looking at this case and looking for, you know, reasons not to decide it, which is really what the three-year rule, which is really what I think the board said, is you really shouldn't get to our argument because, after all, it's technical and it's a technicality. One thing we know, and really the only thing we know about what Congress has done here, is Congress thought repose was important. It set a three-year time limit to give us that repose. And so long as they could fairly have gotten their case done within that three-year period, and we say they can because they had 11 months notice where they could have asked for the opportunity, there's no reason not to apply the rule as written. And the fact, by the way, even if you could read the board's order in November as saying, we only want to hear about the traffic you've already got, so what? In other words, if you think you've got a due process claim, you've got to make it. The court in Levine had also emptied the courtroom of people, of the public. And the Supreme Court said, you've got to ask for the public to come back and say it violates your rights to have them out of here in order to preserve your claim. And it is surely completely unimportant what our view would have been, BNSF's view would have been of such a request. Whether we agreed with them or not, heck, the prosecutor might not have agreed in Duckett with the defendant, and the prosecutor might not have agreed with the defendant in Levine. That can't be the standard, whether
the
we'd have opposed them.
Is flawed. And
okay.
You can understand that. I mean, this is not an either-or situation. The board said, here, we're going to let you do this. Levine, we're going to let some people back in the courtroom, but not everybody. I mean...
Oh, no, Your Honor, I actually think it is appropriate. What the board understood is that even with the traffic group that existed at that time, it needed some additional technical information in order to basically make its decision under ATC. And that's all it was asking for. But if you believed, as WFA did, that you needed to put in a whole case and the due process required that, you had to ask for it. And I submit the reason they didn't ask for it had nothing to do with that they thought the answer would be no. It had everything to do with not wanting to spend the money and hoping that this court ruled for them in major issues.
All right.
There are no more questions. Thank you.